day, even though the round trip was more than 2 miles. Before, she had always taken the bus, which was surely the sensible thing to do, since the stop was right in front of her house. But the one day she had taken it, because her thigh muscles did ache that much, she had got to feeling so uneasy and restless that she'd got off at the second stop. The others agreed, and they all blessed Andy McGee for it, sore muscles and all. Mrs. Gurney had dropped to 250 at her third weigh-in, and when her 6-week course ended, she was down to 225 pounds. She said her husband was stunned at what had happened, especially after her failure with countless dieting programs and fads. He wanted her to go see a doctor. He was afraid she might have cancer. He didn't believe it was possible to lose 75 pounds in 6 weeks by natural means. She showed him her fingers, which were red and calloused from taking in her clothes with needle and thread, and then she threw her arms around him, nearly breaking his back, and wept against his neck. His alumni usually came back, just as his more successful college students usually came back at least once, some to say thanks, some merely to parade their success before him, to say, in effect, "Look here, the student has outraced the teacher," something that was hardly as uncommon as they seemed to think, Andy sometimes thought. But Mrs. Gurney had been one of the former. She had come back to say hello and thanks a lot only 10 days or so before Andy had begun to feel nervous and watched in Port City, and before the end of that month, they had gone on to New York City. Mrs. Gurney was still a big woman. You noticed the startling difference only if you had seen her before, like one of those before and after ads in the magazines. When she dropped in that last time, she was down to 195 pounds. But it wasn't her exact weight that mattered, of course. What mattered was that she was losing weight at the same measured rate of 6 pounds a week, plus or minus 2 pounds, and she would go on losing at a decreasing rate until she was down to 130 pounds, plus or minus 10 pounds. There would be no explosive decompression and no lingering hangover of food horror, the sort of thing that sometimes led to anorexia nervosa. Andy wanted to make some money, but he didn't want to kill anyone doing it. "You ought to be declared a national resource for what you're doing," Mrs. Gurney had declared, after telling Andy that she had effected a rapprochement with her children and that her relations with her husband were improving. Andy had smiled and thanked her, but now, lying on his bed in the darkness, growing drowsy, he reflected that that was pretty close to what had happened to him and Charlie. They had been declared national resources. Still, the talent was not all bad, not when it could help a Mrs. Gurney. He smiled a little, and smiling, slept. Ten. He could never remember the details of the dream afterward. He had been looking for something. He had been in some labyrinthine maze of corridors lit only by dull red trouble lights. He opened doors on empty rooms and then closed them again. Some of the rooms were littered with balls of crumpled paper, and in one there was an overturned table lamp and a fallen picture done in the style of Wyeth. He felt that he was in some sort of installation that had been shut down and cleared out in one hell of a tearing hurry. And yet he had at last found what he was looking for. It was what? A box? A chest? It was terribly heavy, whatever it was, and it had been marked with a white stenciled skull and crossbones, like a jar of rat poison kept on a high cellar shelf. Somehow, in spite of its weight, it had to weigh at least as much as Mrs. Gurney, he managed to pick it up. He could feel all his muscles and tendons pulling taut and hard, yet there was no pain. "Of course there isn't," he told himself. "There's no pain because it's a dream. You'll pay for it later. You'll have the pain later." He carried the box out of the room where he had found it. There was a place he had to take it, but he didn't know what or where it was. "You'll know it when you see it," his mind whispered. So he carried the box or chest up and down endless corridors, its weight tugging painlessly at his muscles, stiffening the back of his neck, and although his muscles didn't hurt, he was getting the beginnings of a headache. "The brain is a muscle," his mind lectured, and the lecture became a chant like a child's song, a little girl's skipping rhyme. "The brain is a muscle that can move the world. The brain is a muscle that can move..." Now all the doors were like subway doors, bulging outward in a slight curve, fitted with large windows. All these windows had rounded corners. Through these doors, if they were doors, he saw a confusion of sights. In one room, Dr. Wanless was playing a huge accordion. He looked like some crazed Lawrence Welk with a tin cup full of pencils in front of him and a sign around his neck that read, "There are none so blind as those who will not see." Through another window he could see a girl in a white caftan flying through the air screaming, careening off the walls, and Andy hurried past that one quickly. Through another he saw Charlie, and he became convinced again that this was some sort of pirate dream, buried treasure, yo-ho-ho, and all of that, because Charlie appeared to be talking with Long John Silver. This man had a parrot on his shoulder and an eye patch over one eye. He was grinning at Charlie with a kind of smarmy false friendship that made Andy nervous. As if in confirmation of this, the one-eyed pirate slipped an arm around Charlie's shoulders and cried hoarsely, "We'll do him yet, kid!" Andy wanted to stop there and knock on the window until he attracted Charlie's attention. She was staring at the pirate as if hypnotized. He wanted to make sure she saw through this strange man, to make sure she understood that he wasn't what he seemed. But he couldn't stop. He had this damned box, chest, to what? Just what the hell was he supposed to do with it? But he would know when it was time. He went past dozens of other rooms. He couldn't remember all of the things he saw. And then he was in a long blank corridor that ended in a blank wall, but not entirely blank. There was something in the exact center of it. A big steel rectangle, like a mail slot. Then he saw the word that had been stamped on it in raised letters and understood. "Disposal," it read. And suddenly Mrs. Gurney was beside him, a slim and pretty Mrs. Gurney with a shapely body and trim legs that looked made for dancing all night long, dancing on a terrace until the stars went pale in the sky and dawn rose in the east like sweet music. You'd never guess, he thought, bemused, that her clothes were once made by Omar the tent maker. He tried to lift the box, but couldn't. Suddenly, it was just too heavy. His headache was worse. It was like the black horse, the riderless horse with the red eyes. And with dawning horror, he realized it was loose. It was somewhere in this abandoned installation, and it was coming for him, thudding. Thudding. "I'll help you," Mrs. Gurney said. "You helped me, now I'll help you. After all, you are the national resource, not me." "You look so pretty," he said. His voice seemed to come from far away through the thickening headache. "I feel like I've been let out of prison," Mrs. Gurney responded. "Let me help you." "It's just that my head aches." "Of course it does. After all, the brain is a muscle." Did she help him, or did he do it himself? He couldn't remember, but he could remember thinking that he understood the dream now. It was the push he was getting rid of, once and for all, the push. He remembered tipping the box against the slot marked disposal, tipping it up, wondering what it would look like when it came out, this thing that had sat inside his brain since his college days. But it wasn't the push that came out. He felt both surprise and fear as the top opened. What spilled into the chute was a flood of blue pills, his pills, and he was scared all right. He was, in the words of Grandpa McGee, suddenly scared enough to shit nickels. "No," he shouted. "Yes," Mrs. Gurney answered firmly. "The brain is a muscle that can move the world." Then he saw it her way. It seemed that the more he poured, the more his head ached, and the more his head ached, the darker it got, until there was no light. The dark was total. It was a living dark. Someone had blown all the fuses somewhere, and there was no light, no box, no dream, only his headache, and the riderless horse with the red eyes coming on and coming on. Thud. 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 He must have been awake a long time before he actually realized he was awake. The total lack of light made the exact dividing line hard to find. A few years before, he had read of an experiment in which a number of monkeys had been put into environments designed to muffle all their senses. The monkeys had all gone crazy. He could understand why. He had no idea how long he had been sleeping, no concrete input except, "Ow, Jesus!" Sitting up drove two monstrous bolts of chromium pain into his head. He clapped his hands to his skull and rocked it back and forth, and little by little the pain subsided to a more manageable level. No concrete sensory input except this rotten headache. "I must have slept on my neck or something," he thought. "I must have..." No. Oh, no, he knew this headache, knew it well. It was the sort of headache he got from a medium to hard push, harder than the ones he had given the fat ladies and shy businessmen, not quite as hard as the ones he had given the fellows at the turnpike rest stop that time. Andy's hands flew to his face and felt it all over, from brow to chin. There were no spots where the feeling trailed away to numbness. When he smiled, both corners of his mouth went up just as they always had. He wished to God for a light so he could look into his own eyes in the bathroom mirror to see if either of them showed that telltale blood sheen. Push? Pushing? That was ridiculous. Who was there to push? Who except... His breath slowed to a stop in his throat and then resumed slowly. He had thought of it before, but had never tried it. He thought it would be like overloading a circuit by cycling a charge through it endlessly. He had been scared to try it. "My pill," he thought, "my pill is overdue, and I want it. I really want it. I really need it. My pill will make everything all right." It was just a thought. It brought on no craving at all. The idea of taking a Thorazine had all the emotional gradient of "please pass the butter." The fact was, except for the rotten headache, he felt pretty much all right. And the fact also was he had had headaches a lot worse than this. The one at the Albany airport, for instance. This one was a baby compared to that. "I've pushed myself," he thought, amazed. For the first time he could really understand how Charlie felt, because for the first time he was a little frightened by his own psi talent. For the first time he really understood how little he understood about what it was and what it could do. Why had it gone? He didn't know. Why had it come back? He didn't know that either. Did it have something to do with his intense fear in the dark? His sudden feeling that Charlie was being threatened? He had a ghostly memory of the piratical one-eyed man, and then it floated away, gone. And his own dismal self-loathing at the way he had forgotten her? Possibly even the rap on the head he had taken when he fell down? He didn't know. He knew only that he had pushed himself. The brain is a muscle that can move the world. It suddenly occurred to him that while he was giving little nudges to businessmen and fat ladies, he could have become a one-man drug rehabilitation center, and he was seized in a shivery ecstasy of dawning supposition. He had gone to sleep thinking that a talent that could help poor fat Mrs. Gurney couldn't be all bad. What about a talent that could knock the monkey off the back of every poor junkie in New York City? What about that, sports fans? "Jesus," he whispered, "am I really clean?" There was no craving. Thorazine, the image of the blue pill on the white plate, that thought had become unmistakably neutral. "I am clean," he answered himself. Next question, could he stay clean? But he had no more than asked himself that one when other questions flooded in. Could he find out exactly what was happening to Charlie? He had used the push on himself in his sleep, like a kind of auto-hypnosis. Could he use it on others while awake? The endlessly, repulsively grinning Pinchot, for instance. Pinchot would know what was happening to Charlie. Could he be made to tell? Could he maybe even get her out of here after all? Was there a way to do that? And if they did get out, what then? No more running, for one thing. That was no solution. There had to be a place to go. For the first time in months, he felt excited, hopeful. He began to try scraps of plan, accepting, rejecting, questioning. For the first time in months, he felt at home in his own head, alive and vital, capable of action. And above all else, there was this. If he could fool them into believing two things, that he was still drugged and that he was still incapable of using his mental domination talent, he just might have a chance of doing something. He was still turning it all over restlessly in his mind when the lights came back on. In the other room, the TV began spouting that same old, "Jesus will take care of your soul and we'll take care of your bank book" jive. The eyes, the electric eyes, they're watching you again, or soon will be. Don't forget that. For one moment, everything came home to him, the days and weeks of subterfuge that would surely lie ahead if he was to have any chance at all, and the near certainty that he would be caught at some point. Depression waved in, but it brought no craving for the pill with it, and that helped him to catch hold of himself. He thought of Charlie, and that helped more. He got up slowly from the bed and walked into the living room. "What happened?" he cried loudly. "I was scared. Where's my medication? Somebody bring me my medication." He sat down in front of the TV, his face slack and dull and heavy. And behind that vapid face, his brain, that muscle that could move the world, ticked away faster and faster. XII. Like the dream her father had had at the same time, Charlie McGee could never remember the details of her long conversation with John Rainbird, only the high spots. She was never quite sure how she came to pour out the story of how she came to be here, or to speak of her intense loneliness for her father, and her terror that they would find some way to trick her into using her pyrokinetic ability again. Part of it was the blackout, of course, and the knowledge that they weren't listening. Part of it was John himself. He had been through so much, and he was so pathetically afraid of the dark and of the memories it brought of the terrible hole those Kongs had put him in. He had asked her almost apathetically why they had locked her up, and she had begun talking just to distract his mind. But it had quickly become more than that. It began to come out faster and faster, everything she had kept bottled up until the words were tumbling out all over one another, helter-skelter. Once or twice she had cried, and he held her clumsily. He was a sweet man. In many ways, he reminded her of her father. "Now if they find out you know all of that," she said, "they'll probably lock you up, too. I shouldn't have told."
"They'd lock me up, all right," John said cheerfully. "I got a D clearance kid. That gives me clearance to open bottles of Johnson's wax, and that's about all." He laughed. "We'll be all right if you don't let on that you told me, I guess."
"I won't," Charlie said eagerly. She had been a little uneasy herself, thinking if John told, they might use him on her like a lever. "I'm awful thirsty. There's ice water in the refrigerator. You want some?"
"Don't leave me," he said immediately.
"Well, let's go together. We'll hold hands."
He appeared to think about this. "All right," he said. They shuffled across to the kitchen together, hands gripped tightly. "You better not let on, kid. Especially about this. Heap big Indian afraid of the dark. The guys had laughed me right out of this place."
"They wouldn't laugh if they knew.
Maybe not. Maybe so." He chuckled a little. "But I'd just as soon they never found out. I just thank God you was here, kid."
She was so touched that her eyes filled again, and she had to struggle for control of herself. They reached the fridge, and she located the jug of ice water by feel. It wasn't icy cold anymore, but it soothed her throat. She wondered with fresh unease just how long she had talked and didn't know, but she had told everything, even the parts she had meant to hold back, like what had happened at the Manders farm. Of course, the people like Hochstetter knew, but she didn't care about them. She did care about John and his opinion of her. But she had told. He would ask a question that somehow pierced right to the heart of the matter, and she had told, often with tears. And instead of more questions and cross-examination and mistrust, there had been only acceptance and calm sympathy. He seemed to understand the hell she had been through, maybe because he had been through hell himself. "Here's the water," she said.
"Thanks." She heard him drink, and then it was placed back in her hands. "Thanks a lot." She put it away. "Let's go back in the other room," he said. "I wonder if they'll ever get the lights back on." He was impatient for them to come on now. They had been off more than 7 hours, he guessed. He wanted to get out of here and think about all of this. Not what she had told him, he knew all of that, but how to use it.
"I'm sure they'll be on soon," Charlie said. They shuffled their way back to the sofa and sat down.
"They haven't told you anything about your old man?"
"Just that he's all right," she said.
I'll bet I could get in to see him, Rainbird said, as if this idea had just occurred to him. You could? You really think you could?
I could change with Herbie someday. See him, tell him you're okay. Well, not tell him, but pass him a note or something.
Oh, wouldn't that be dangerous?
It would be dangerous to make a business of it, kid, but I owe you one. I'll see how he is.
She threw her arms around him in the dark and kissed him. Rainbird gave her an affectionate hug. In his own way, he loved her, now more than ever. She was his now, and he supposed he was hers, for a while.
They sat together, not talking much, and Charlie dozed. Then he said something that woke her up as suddenly and completely as a dash of cold water in the face. Shit. You ought to light their damn fires, if you can do it.
Charlie sucked her breath in, shocked, as if he had suddenly hit her. I told you, she said. It's like letting a wild animal out of a cage. I promised myself I'd never do it again. That soldier at the airport and those men at that farm, I killed them. Burned them up. Her face was hot, burning, and she was on the verge of tears again.
The way you told it, it sounded like self-defense.
Yes, but that's no excuse to...
It also sounded like maybe you saved your old man's life.
Silence from Charlie. But he could feel trouble and confusion and misery coming off her in waves. He hastened on, not wanting her to remember right now that she had come very close to killing her father as well.
As for that guy Hochstetter, I've seen him around. I saw guys like him in the war. Every one of them a 90-day wonder, king shit of Turned Mountain. If he can't get what he wants from you one way, he'll try some other way.
That's what scares me the most, she admitted in a low voice.
Besides, there's one guy who could use a hot foot.
Charlie was shocked, but giggled hard, the way a dirty joke could sometimes make her laugh harder just because it was so bad to tell them. When she was over her giggles, she said, No, I won't light fires. I promised myself. It's bad, and I won't.
It was enough.
It was time to stop. He felt that he could keep going on pure intuition, but he recognized that it might be a false feeling. He was tired now. Working on the girl had been every bit as exhausting as working on one of Ramadan's safes. It would be too easy to go on and make a mistake that could never be undone.
Yeah, okay. I guess you're right.
You really will see my dad?
I'll try, kid.
I'm sorry you got stuck in here with me, John, but I'm awful glad, too.
Yeah.
They talked of inconsequential things, and she put her head on his arm. He felt that she was dozing off again. It was very late now, and when the lights went on about 40 minutes later, she was fast asleep. The light in her face made her stir and turn her head into his darkness. He looked down thoughtfully at the slender willow stem of her neck, the tender curve of her skull. So much power in that small, delicate cradle of bone. Could it be true? His mind still rejected it, but his heart felt it was so. It was a strange and somehow wonderful feeling to find himself so divided. His heart felt it was true to an extent they wouldn't believe, true perhaps to the extent of that mad Wanless's ravings. He picked her up, carried her to her bed, and slipped her between the sheets. As he pulled them up to her chin, she stirred half awake. He leaned over impulsively and kissed her.
Good night, kid.
Good night, Daddy, she said in a thick, sleeping voice. Then she rolled over and became still. He looked down at her for several minutes longer, then went back into the living room. Hochstetter himself came bustling in 10 minutes later.
Power failure, he said. Storm. Damn electronic locks, all jammed. Is she... She'll be fine if you keep your goddamn voice down, Rainbird said in a low voice.
His huge hands pistoned out, caught Hochstetter by the lapels of his white lab coat, and jerked him forward, so that Hochstetter's suddenly terrified face was less than an inch from his own.
And if you ever behave as if you know me in here again, if you ever behave toward me as if I am anything but a D-clearance orderly, I'll kill you. And then I'll cut you into pieces and Cuisinart you and turn you into cat meat.
Hochstetter sputtered impotently. Spit bubbled at the corners of his lips.
Do you understand? I'll kill you.
He shook Hockstetter twice.
I understand.
Then let's get out of here, Rainbird said, and shoved Hockstetter, pale and wide-eyed, out into the corridor. He took one last look around and then wheeled his cart out and closed the self-locking door behind him. In the bedroom, Charlie slept on, more peacefully than she had in months, perhaps years. Small Fires, Big Brother. 1. The violent storm passed. Time passed, 3 weeks of it. Summer, humid and overbearing, still held sway over eastern Virginia, but school was back in session, and lumbering yellow school buses trundled up and down the well-kept rural roads in the Longmont area. In not-too-distant Washington, D.C., another year of legislation, rumor, and innuendo was beginning, marked with the usual freak show atmosphere engendered by national television, planned information leaks, and overmastering clouds of bourbon fumes. None of that made much of an impression in the cool, environmentally controlled rooms of the two antebellum houses and the corridors and levels honeycombed beneath. The only correlative might have been that Charlie McGee was also going to school. It was Hockstetter's idea that she be tutored, and Charlie had balked, but John Rainbird had talked her into it. "What hurt's it gonna do?" he asked. "There's no sense in a smart girl like you getting way behind." "Shit! Excuse me, Charlie, but I wish to God sometimes that I had more than an eighth-grade education. I wouldn't be mopping floors now. You can bet your boots on that. Besides, it'll pass the time." So she had done it for John. The tutors came. The young man who taught English, the older woman who taught mathematics, the younger woman with the thick glasses who began to teach her French, the man in the wheelchair who taught science. She listened to them, and she supposed she learned, but she had done it for John. On three occasions, John had risked his job to pass her father notes, and she felt guilty about that, and hence was more willing to do what she thought would please John. And he had brought her news of her dad, that he was well, that he was relieved to know Charlie was well, too, and that he was cooperating with their tests. This had distressed her a little, but she was now old enough to understand, a little bit anyway, that what was best for her might not always be best for her father, and lately she had begun to wonder more and more if John might know best about what was right for her. In his earnest, funny way, he was always swearing and then apologizing for it, which made her giggle, he was very persuasive. He had not said anything about making fires for almost 10 days after the blackout. Whenever they talked of these things, they did it in the kitchen, where he said there were no bugs, and they always talked in low voices. On that day he had said, "You thought any more about that fire business, Charlie?" He always called her Charlie now instead of Kid. She had asked him to. She began to tremble. Just thinking about making fires had this effect on her since the Manders farm. She got cold and tense and trembly. On Hockstetter's reports, this was called a mild phobic reaction. "I told you," she said, "I can't do that. I won't do that."
"Now can't and won't aren't the same thing," John said.
He was washing the floor, but very slowly, so he could talk to her. His mop swished. He talked the way cons talk in prison, barely moving his lips. Charlie didn't reply.
"I just had a couple of thoughts on this," he said. "But if you don't want to hear them, if your head's really set, I'll just shut up."
"No, that's okay," Charlie said politely. But she did really wish he would shut up, not talk about it, not even think about it, because it made her feel bad. But John had done so much for her, and she desperately didn't want to offend him or hurt his feelings. She needed a friend.
"Well, I was just thinking that they must know how it got out of control at that farm," he said. "They'd probably be really careful. I don't think they'd be apt to test you in a room full of paper and oily rags, do you?"
"No, but..." He raised one hand a little way off his mop.
"Hear me out. Hear me out."
"Okay."
"And they sure know that was the only time you caused a real... what's it? A conflagration. Small fires, Charlie. That's the ticket, small fires. And if something did happen, which I doubt, because I think you got better control over yourself than you think you do, but say something did happen, Who they gonna blame, huh? They gonna blame you? After the fuckhead spent half a year twisting your arm to do it? Oh, hell, I'm sorry.
The things he was saying scared her, but still she had to put her hands to her mouth and giggle at the woebegone expression on his face.
John smiled a little, too, then shrugged.
The other thing I was thinking is that you can't learn to control something unless you practice it and practice it.
I don't care if I ever control it or not, because I'm just not going to do it.
Maybe or maybe not, John said stubbornly, wringing out his mop.
He stood it in the corner, then dumped his soapy water down the sink. He began to run a bucket afresh to rinse with.
You might get surprised into using it.
No, I don't think so.
Or suppose you got a bad fever sometime, from the flu or the croup or, hell, I don't know, some kind of infection.
This was one of the few profitable lines Hockstetter had given him to pursue.
You ever have your appendix out, Charlie?
No.
John began to rinse the floor.
My brother had his out, but it went bust first and he almost died. That was 'cause we were reservation Indians and nobody cared much if we lived or died. He got a high fever, 105, I guess, and he went raving right off his head, saying horrible curses and talking to people who weren't there. Do you know he thought our father was the angel of death or something, come to carry him off? And he tried to stick him with a knife that was on his bedside table there? I told you this story, didn't I?
No, Charlie said, whispering now not to keep from being overheard but out of horrified fascination.
Really?
Really,
John affirmed. He squeezed the mop out again. It wasn't his fault. It was the fever that did it. People are apt to say or do anything when they're delirious. Anything.
Charlie understood what he was saying and felt a sinking fear. Here was something she had never even considered.
But if you had control of this pyro-what's-his?
How could I have control of it if I was delirious?
Just because you do.
Rainbird went back to Wanless's original metaphor, the one that had so disgusted Cap almost a year ago now.
It's like toilet training, Charlie. Once you get hold of your bowels and bladder, you're in control for good. Delirious people sometimes get their beds all wet from sweat, but they rarely piss the bed.
Hockstetter had pointed out that this was not invariably true, but Charlie wouldn't know that.
Well, anyway, all I mean is that if you got control, don't you see, you wouldn't have to worry about this anymore. You'd have it licked. But to get control, you have to practice and practice. The same way you learn to tie your shoes, or to make your letters in kindergarten.
I just don't want to make fires, and I won't, I won't!
There, I went and upset you, John said, distressed. I sure didn't mean to do that. I'm sorry, Charlie. I won't say no more, me and my big fat mouth.
But the next time she brought it up herself.
It was 3 or 4 days later, and she had thought over the things he had said very carefully, and she believed that she had put her finger on the one flaw. It would just never end, she said. They'd always want more and more and more. If you only knew the way they chased us, they never give up. Once I started, they'd want bigger fires, and then even bigger ones, and then bonfires, and then... I don't know. But I'm afraid.
He admired her again. She had an intuition and a native wit that was incredibly sharp. He wondered what Hockstetter would think when he, Rainbird, told him that Charlie McGee had an extremely good idea what their top-secret master plan was. All of their reports on Charlie theorized that pyrokinesis was only the centerpiece of many related psionic talents, and Rainbird believed that her intuition was one of them. Her father had told them again and again that Charlie had known Al Steinowitz and the others were coming up to the Manders farm even before they had arrived. That was a scary thought. If she should ever get one of her funny intuitions about his authenticity, well... They said hell had no fury like a woman scorned, and if half of what he believed about Charlie was true, then she was perfectly capable of manufacturing hell, or a reasonable facsimile. He might suddenly find himself getting very hot. It added a certain spice to the proceedings, a spice that had been missing for too long.
"Charlie," he said, "I'm not saying you should do any of these things for free."
She looked at him puzzled. John sighed.
I don't hardly know how to put it to you, he said. I guess I love you a little. You're like the daughter I never had. And the way they're keeping you cooped up here, not letting you see your daddy and all, never getting to go out, missing all the things other little girls have, it just about makes me sick. Now he allowed his good eye to blaze out at her, scaring her a little. You could get all kinds of things just by going along with them and attaching a few strings.
Strings? Charlie said, utterly mystified.
Yeah. You could get them to let you go outside in the sun, I bet. Maybe even into Longmont to shop for things. You could get out of this goddamn box and into a regular house, see other kids, and see my father?
Sure, that too.
But that was one thing that was never going to happen, because if the two of them put their information together, they would realize that John, the friendly orderly, was just too good to be true. Rainbird had never passed along a single message to Andy McGee. Hockstetter thought it would be running a risk for no gain, and Rainbird, who thought Hockstetter a total bleeding asshole about most things, agreed. It was one thing to fool an 8-year-old kid with fairy stories about there being no bugs in the kitchen, and about how they could talk in low voices and not be overheard, but it would be quite another thing to fool the girl's father with the same fairy story, even though he was hooked through the bag and back. McGee might not be hooked enough to miss the fact that they were now doing little more than playing nice guy and mean guy with Charlie, a technique police departments have used to crack criminals for hundreds of years. So he maintained the fiction that he was taking her messages to Andy just as he was maintaining so many other fictions. It was true that he saw Andy quite often, but he saw him only on the TV monitors. It was true that Andy was cooperating with their tests, but it was also true that he was tipped over, unable to push a kid into eating a popsicle. He had turned into a big fat zero, concerned only with what was on the tube and when his next pill was going to arrive, and he never asked to see his daughter anymore. Meeting her father face to face and seeing what they had done to him might stiffen her resistance all over again, and he was very close to breaking her now. She wanted to be convinced now. No, all things were negotiable except that. Charlie McGee was never going to see her father again. Before too long, Rainbird surmised, Cap would have McGee on a shop plane to the Maui compound. But the girl didn't need to know that, either.
You really think they'd let me see him?
No question about it, he responded easily. Not at first, of course. He's their ace with you, and they know it, but if you went to a certain point, and then said you were going to cut them off unless they let you see him... He let it dangle there. The bait was out, a big sparkling lure dragged through the water. It was full of hooks and not good to eat anyway, but that was something else this tough little chick didn't know. She looked at him thoughtfully. No more was said about it that day. Now, about a week later, Rainbird abruptly reversed his field. He did this for no concrete reason, but his own intuition told him he could get no further by advocacy. It was time to beg, as Br'er Rabbit had begged Br'er Fox not to be thrown into that briar patch. "You remember what we was talking about?" He opened the conversation. He was waxing the kitchen floor. She was pretending to linger over her selection of a snack from the fridge. One clean pink foot was cocked behind the other so he could see the sole, a pose that he found curiously evocative of mid-childhood. It was somehow pre-erotic, almost mystic. His heart went out to her again. Now she looked back over her shoulder at him doubtfully. Her hair, done up in a ponytail, lay over one shoulder.
"Yes," she said, "I remember."
"Well, I've been thinking, and I started to ask myself what makes me an expert on giving advice," he said. "I can't even float a $1,000 bank loan for a car."
"Oh, John, that doesn't mean anything."
"Yes, it does. If I knew something, I'd be one of those guys like that Hockstetter, college-educated."
With great disdain, she replied, "My daddy says any fool can buy a college education somewhere." In his heart, he rejoiced.
2. 3 days after that, the fish swallowed the lure. Charlie told him that she had decided to let them make their tests. She would be careful, she said, and she would make them be careful if they didn't know how. Her face was thin and pinched and pale.
"Don't you do it," John said, "unless you've thought it all out."
"I've tried," she whispered.
Are you doing it for them?
No.
Good. Are you doing it for you?
Yes, for me, and for my father.
All right, he said. And Charlie, make them play it your way. Understand me? You've shown them how tough you can be. Don't let them see a weak streak now. If they see it, they'll use it. Play tough. You know what I mean?
I think so.
They get something, you get something. Every time. No freebies.
His shoulders slumped a bit.
The fire went out of his eye.
She hated to see him this way, looking depressed and defeated.
Don't let them treat you like they treated me. I gave my country 4 years of my life and one eye. One of those years I spent in a hole in the ground eating bugs and running a fever and smelling my own shit all the time and picking lice out of my hair. And when I got out, they said, "Thanks a lot, John," and put a mop in my hand. They stole from me, Charlie. Get it? Don't let them do that to you.
I get it, she said solemnly.
He brightened a little, then smiled. So, when's the big day?
I'm seeing Dr. Hochstetter tomorrow. I'll tell him I've decided to cooperate. A little. And I'll tell him what I want.
Well, just don't ask for too much at first. It's just like the carny at the midway, Charlie. You got to show him some flesh before you take their cash.
She nodded.
But you show them who's in the saddle, right? Show them who's boss.
Right.
He smiled more broadly. Good kid, he said. Three. Hochstetter was furious. What the hell sort of game are you playing? He shouted at Rainbird. They were in Cap's office. He dared to shout, Rainbird thought, because Cap was here to play referee. Then he took a second look at Hochstetter's hot blue eyes, his flushed cheeks, his white knuckles, and admitted that he was probably wrong. He had dared to make his way through the gates and into Hochstetter's sacred garden of privilege. The shaking out Rainbird had administered after the blackout ended was one thing. Hochstetter had lapsed dangerously and had known it. This was something else altogether. He thought. Rainbird only stared at Hochstetter.
You've carefully set it up around an impossibility. You know damned well she isn't going to see her father. They get something, you get something? Hochstetter mimicked furiously. You fool.
Rainbird continued to stare at Hochstetter. Don't call me a fool again, he said in a perfectly neutral voice. Hochstetter flinched, but only a little.
Please, gentlemen, Cap said wearily. Please.
There was a tape recorder on his desk. They had just finished listening to the conversation Rainbird had had with Charlie that morning.
Apparently, Dr. Hochstetter has missed the point that he and his team are finally going to get something, Rainbird said, which will improve their store of practical knowledge by 100%, if my mathematics are correct.
As the result of a totally unforeseen accident, Hochstetter said sullenly.
An accident you people were too short-sighted to manufacture for yourselves, Rainbird countered. Too busy playing with your rats, maybe.
Gentlemen, that's enough, Cap said. We're not here to indulge in a lot of recriminations. That is not the purpose of this meeting.
He looked at Hochstetter.
You're going to get to play ball, he said. I must say you show remarkably little gratitude.
Hochstetter muttered. Cap looked at Rainbird.
All the same, I also think you took your role of amicus curiae a little bit too far in the end.
Do you think so?
Then you still don't understand.
He looked from Cap to Hochstetter and then back to Cap again.
I think both of you have shown an almost paralyzing lack of understanding. You've got two child psychiatrists at your disposal, and if they are an accurate representation of the caliber of that field, there are a lot of disturbed kids out there who have got big-time trouble.
Easy to say, Hochstetter said. This, you just don't understand how smart she is, Rainbird cut him off. You don't understand how adept she is at seeing the causes and effects of things. Working with her is like picking your way through a minefield. I pointed out the carrot and stick idea to her because she would have thought of it herself. By thinking of it for her, I've shored up the trust she has in me. In effect, turned a disadvantage into an advantage.
Hochstetter opened his mouth. Cap held up one hand and then turned to Rainbird. He spoke in a soft, placatory tone that he used with no one else. But then, no one else was John Rainbird. That doesn't alter the fact that you seem to have limited how far Hochstetter and his people can go. Sooner or later, she's going to understand that her ultimate request, to see her father, is not going to be granted. We're all in agreement that to allow that might close off her usefulness to us forever.
Right on, Hochstetter said. And if she's as sharp as you say, Cap said, she's apt to make the ungrantable request sooner rather than later.
She'll make it, Rainbird agreed, and that will end it. For one thing, she'd realize as soon as she saw him that I was lying all along about his condition. That would lead her to the conclusion that I had been shilling for you guys all along.
So it becomes entirely a question of how long you can keep her going. Rainbird leaned forward. A couple of points. First, you've both got to get used to the idea that she's simply not going to light fires for you ad infinitum. She's a human being. A little girl who wants to see her father. She's not a lab rat.
We've already...
Hochstetter began impatiently.
No. No, you haven't. It goes back to the very basis of the reward system in experimentation. The carrot and the stick. By lighting fires, Charlie thinks she's holding the carrot out to you, and that she will eventually lead you and herself to her father. But we know differently. In truth, her father is the carrot, and we are leading her. Now a mule will plow the whole South 40 trying to get that carrot dangling in front of his eyes, because a mule is stupid. But this little girl isn't.
He looked at Cap and Hochstetter.
I keep saying that. It is like pounding a nail into oak, oak of the first cutting. Hard going, don't you know? You both seem to keep forgetting. Sooner or later, she's going to wise up and tell you to stick it, because she isn't a mule, or a white lab rat.
And you want her to quit, Cap thought with slow loathing. You want her to quit so you can kill her.
So you start with that one basic fact, Rainbird continued. That's go. Then you start thinking of ways to prolong her cooperation as long as possible. Then, when it's over, you write your report. If you've got enough data, you get rewarded with a big cash appropriation. You get to eat the carrot. Then you can start injecting a bunch of poor, ignorant slobs with your witch's brew all over again.
You're being insulting, Hochstetter said in a shaking voice.
It beats the terminal stupids, Rainbird answered.
How do you propose to prolong her cooperation?
You'll get some mileage out of her just by granting small privileges, Rainbird said. A walk on the lawn, or every little girl loves horses. I'll bet you could get half a dozen fires out of her just by having a groom lead her around the bridle paths on one of those stable nags. That ought to be enough to keep a dozen paper pushers like Hochstetter dancing on the head of a pin for 5 years.
Hochstetter pushed back from the table.
I don't have to sit here and listen to this. Sit down and shut up, Cap said.
Hot blood slammed into Hochstetter's face, and he looked ready to fight. It left as suddenly as it had come, and he looked ready to cry. Then he sat down again.
You let her go into town and shop, Rainbird said. Maybe you arrange for her to go to Seven Flags over Georgia and ride the roller coaster. Maybe even with her good friend John, the orderly.
You seriously think just those things? Cap began.
No, I don't. Not for long. Sooner or later, it will get back to her father. But she's only human. She wants things for herself as well. She'll go quite a ways down the road you want her to go down just by rationalizing it to herself, telling herself she's showing you the flash before grabbing the cash. But eventually, it's going to get back to dear old Dad's, yes. She's no sellout, that one. She's tough.
And that's the end of the trolley car ride, Cap said thoughtfully. Everybody out. The project ends, this phase of it, anyway.
In many ways, the prospect of an end in sight relieved him tremendously.
Not right then, no, Rainbird said, smiling his mirthless smile. We have one more card up our sleeve. One more very large carrot when the smaller ones play out. Not her father, not the grand prize, but something that will keep her going yet a while longer.
And what would that be? Hochstetter asked.
You figure it out,
Rainbird said, still smiling, and said no more. Cap might, in spite of how far he had come unraveled over the last half year or so. He had more smarts on half power than most of his employees, and all the pretenders to his throne had on full power. As for Hochstetter, he would never see it. Hochstetter had risen several floors past his level of incompetency, a feat more possible in the federal bureaucracy than elsewhere. Hochstetter would have trouble following his nose to a shit and cream cheese sandwich. Not that it mattered if any of them figured out what the final carrot, the game carrot, one might say, in this little contest was. The results would still be the same. It was going to put him comfortably in the driver's seat one way or the other. He might have asked them, "Who do you think her father is now that her father isn't there?" Let them figure it out for themselves, if they could. John Rainbird went on smiling. Four. Andy McGee sat in front of his television set. The little amber home box office pilot light glowed in the square gadget on top of the TV. On the screen, Richard Dreyfuss was trying to build the Devil's Butte in his living room. Andy watched with a calm and vapid expression of pleasure. Inside, he was boiling with nervousness. Today was the day. For Andy, the 3 weeks since the blackout had been a period of almost unbearable tension and strain, interwoven with bright threads of guilty exhilaration. He could understand simultaneously how the Russian KGB could inspire such terror, and how George Orwell's Winston Smith must have enjoyed his brief period of crazy, furtive rebellion. He had a secret again. It gnawed and worked in him, as all grave secrets do within the minds of their keepers, but it also made him feel whole and potent again. He was putting one over on them. God knew how long he would be able to continue, or if it would come to anything, but right now he was doing it. It was almost 10 in the morning, and Pinchot, that eternally grinning man, was coming at 10. They would be going for a walk in the garden to discuss his progress. Andy intended to push him, or to at least try. He might have made the effort before this, except for the TV monitors and the endless bugging devices, and the wait had given him time to think out his line of attack and probe it again and again for weak spots. He had, in fact, rewritten parts of the scenario in his mind many times. At night, lying in bed in the dark, he had thought over and over again, "Big Brother is watching. Just keep telling yourself that. Keep it foremost in your mind. They've got you locked up right in the forebrain of Big Brother, and if you really expect to help Charlie, you've got to keep on fooling them." He was sleeping less than he ever had in his life, mostly because he was terrified of talking in his sleep. Some nights he lay wakeful for hours, afraid even to toss and turn in case they should wonder why a drugged man should be so restless. And when he did sleep, it was thin, shot with strange dreams. Often the Long John Silver figure, the one-eyed pirate with the peg leg, recurred in these, and easily broken. Slipping the pills was the easiest part, because they believed he wanted them. The pills came 4 times a day now, and there had been no more tests since the blackout. He believed they had given up, and that was what Pinchot wanted to tell him today on his walk. Sometimes he would cough the pills out of his mouth into his cupped hand and put them in food scraps he would later scrape down the garbage disposal. More went down the toilet. Still others he had pretended to take with ginger ale. He spat the pills into the half-empty cans to dissolve and then let them stand, as if forgotten. Later, he would turn them down the sink. God knew he was no professional at this, and presumably the people who were monitoring him were, but he didn't think they were monitoring him very closely anymore. If they were, he would be caught. That was all. Dreyfuss and the woman whose son had been taken for a ride by the saucer people were scaling the side of Devil's Butte when the buzzer that marked the breaking of the door circuit went off briefly. Andy didn't let himself jump. "This is it," he told himself again. Herman Pinchot came into the living room. He was shorter than Andy, but very slender. There was something about him that had always struck Andy as slightly effeminate, although it was nothing you could put your finger on. Today he was looking extremely reet and complete in a thin gray turtleneck sweater and a summerweight jacket, and of course he was grinning. "Good morning, Andy," he said. Oh, Andy said, and then paused as if to think. Hello, Dr. Pinchot.
Do you mind if I turn this off?
We ought to go for our walk, you know. Oh, Andy's brow furrowed, then cleared. Sure, I've seen it 3 or 4 times already, but I like the ending. It's pretty. The UFOs take him away, you know, to the stars.
Really?
Pinchot said, and turned off the TV.
Shall we go?
Where? Andy asked. Our walk, Herman Pinchot said patiently. Remember? Oh, Andy said. Sure. He got up. Five. The hall outside Andy's room was wide and tile-floored. The lighting was muted and indirect. Somewhere not far away was a communications or computer center. People strolled in with key punch cards, out with swatches of printouts, and there was the hum of light machinery. A young man in an off-the-rack sport coat, the essence of government agent, lounged outside the door of Andy's apartment. There was a bulge under his arm. The agent was a part of the standard operating procedure, but as he and Pinchot strolled, he would fall behind them, watching but out of earshot. Andy thought he would be no problem. The agent fell in behind them now as he and Pinchot strolled to the elevator. Andy's heartbeat was now so heavy it felt as if it were shaking his entire ribcage, but without seeming to, he was watching everything closely. There were perhaps a dozen unmarked doors. Some of them he had seen standing open on other walks up this corridor. A small specialized library of some kind, a photocopying room in another, but about many of them he simply had no idea. Charlie might be behind any one of them right now, or in some other part of the installation entirely. They got into the elevator, which was big enough to accommodate a hospital gurney. Pinchot produced his keys, twisted one of them in the keyway, and pushed one of the unmarked buttons. The doors closed and the elevator rose smoothly. The shop agent lounged at the back of the car. Andy stood with his hands in the pockets of his Lee Riders, a slight, vapid smile on his face. The elevator door opened on what had once been a ballroom. The floor was polished oak, pegged together. Across the wide expanse of the room, a spiral staircase made a graceful double twist on its way to the upper levels. To the left, French doors gave on to a sunny terrace and the rock garden beyond it. From the right, where heavy oak doors stood half open, came the clacking sound of a typing pool, putting out that day's 2 bales of paperwork. And from everywhere came the smell of fresh flowers. Pinchot led the way across the sunny ballroom, and, as always, Andy commented on the pegged-together floor as if he had never noticed it before. They went through the French doors with their shop shadow behind them. It was very warm, very humid. Bees buzzed lazily through the air. Beyond the rock garden were hydrangea, forsythia, and rhododendron bushes. There was the sound of riding lawnmowers making their eternal rounds. Andy turned his face up to the sun with a gratitude that wasn't feigned.
"How are you feeling, Andy?" Pinchot asked.
"Good, good.
You know, you've been here almost half a year now," Pinchot said in an, "Isn't it amazing how the time flies when you're having a good time?" tone of mild surprise.
They turned right onto one of the graveled paths. The smell of honeysuckle and sweet sassafras hung in the still air. On the other side of the duck pond, near the other house, 2 horses cantered lazily along.
"That long?" Andy said.
"Yes, it is a long time," Pinchot said, grinning.
"And we've decided that your power has diminished, Andy. In fact, you know, we've had no appreciable results at all."
"Well, you keep me drugged all the time," Andy said reproachfully. "You can't expect me to do my best if I'm stoned." Pinchot cleared his throat, but did not point out that Andy had been totally clean for the first 3 series of tests, and all 3 had been fruitless.
"I mean, I've done my best, Dr. Pinchot. I've tried." "Yes, yes, of course you have, and we think, that is, I think, that you deserve a rest. Now, the shop has a small compound on Maui, in the Hawaii chain, Andy, and I have a 6-month report to write very soon. How would you like it?"
Pinchot's grin broadened into a game show host leer, and his voice took on the tones of a man about to offer a child an incredible treat.
"How would you like it
if I recommended that you be sent there for the immediate future.
And the immediate future?